It's great to be here. I want to say it's been a while. It's been since sometime last year that I was last with Marin Sangha. It's always great to come home, so to speak. So that guided meditation I did was Philip Moffitt's arriving sequence, and I just first wanted to open it up and see if anybody had any comments or questions about that. Okay. I know some folks here at Marin Sangha have not been as interested in the nine bodies practice, and I want to make sure that you all know that this arriving sequence is totally separate from that. As a matter of fact, the first time I heard Philip teach this, I called it the here and now meditation because I didn't know what name he was giving it, but it was at Marin Sangha in 2018. Like in January of 2018. So if you have not used this arriving sequence or work with it over a period of time, and anybody who's open to taking on, and granted it may be an extra practice for you, but I want to encourage you to work with this daily for some period of time, whether that's a month or 3 months or something like that. He did do the arriving sequence when he was here on January 1st of this year, so there is that recording. And you could listen to the first portion of that or whatever. If you did want to work with this, you could do it for listen to the recording either every day or couple times a week, or listen to it a few to several times until you feel like you have it internally, and then practice with it that way. And then anybody who does choose to check out this arriving sequence, making this a regular thing, I will be teaching here a couple times in September, so we can get a sense, we can have an opportunity to check in about that and hear about that. Yeah, the felt sense of ground when we're aligning or aligned, different people get it at different times. It may be with the available, it may be with the aligning part, but it is possible for us in whatever measure. Doesn't mean sometimes I think we have this sense that it's got to be at, nine on the Richter scale in order to count. And no, that's not true. Even if we can know it on a just a very subtle, even just a hint of it, can be very useful. I've found it to be quite useful and impactful in my practice. Philip actually started teaching the arriving sequence based on a retreat he sat with Venerable Analeo, where Venerable Analeo would lead all the practitioners through this element, and then this thing, and this step, all these steps before they quote unquote started the meditation. And so Philip realized that he'd been doing his own sequence to start meditation, to start his own personal meditations, but that he'd never taught that. So he started doing that 5, 6 years ago. And I guess I think if this is something, a meditator like him is doing regularly, it may be worth checking out. That might be something worth checking out. And then if you do it, if you do practice with this for a period of time, if nothing happens, then nothing happens. We can be fine with that. Okay, so this idea of being fine with whatever it is that comes will make for a good segue to the rest of my talk. I'm going to start this talk with a quote from Mark Braley. I read this an interview with him in a newspaper in the last year or two. He's an 86-year-old water polo player. He joined the UC Davis water polo club team at the age of 76, and he's still playing. He has yet to score a goal. So he's not score he's 0 for his first 10 years with water polo, and he's still doing it. And so in this interview, one of the things they asked him is, What have you learned about yourself through the sport? And he said a couple different things. And then one of the things that he said is he said, I've learned that I can do almost anything if I don't mind not being good at it. Being forced to be good at something has excluded me from doing things all my life. What a wonderful quote. I read this, reread this to myself often. I saw this and loved it. What a wonderful lesson. Yeah, would want to bring that into my own life more. And we could apply this, any of us could apply this to any aspect of our life, to learning a new language, taking a dance class, doing yoga. We could take this on in our learning to be what, more kind in our social life or more caring towards others or with partner, with friends, with family. And we could also apply this to our practice. We could apply it to the arriving sequence or any other aspect of our practice. Okay. So if you, when hearing about my suggestion of practicing with the arriving sequence, if you had some reaction or thought of, I can't do this or it won't work for me or not one more new thing, first, just receiving those thought, that thought or those thoughts, just receiving those with mindfulness. Just taking them in and let that rest there and know the truth of your experience. I feel like I'm somebody who, as a meditator, has been someone who I have certainly had my share of struggles as a meditator. There's some people, I spent some time as a monk in Burma, and there's this one monk who was at that monastery. He's a Canadian monk, Ujagara. Some of you may have heard of him. I heard this story, and it could be completely made up, but I heard it at the monastery about him that he was going camping by himself, and he had heard about meditation, and he picked up a couple books at the library, and he goes off and camping, and he sets up his tent, and he climbs in his tent at the end of the evening, and he picks up this book to read it, and he starts reading about how you do this meditation, and he starts meditating, and there's this bright light that keeps coming at him, and so eventually he opens his eyes. He doesn't see it anywhere. He unzips the tent to see if like maybe there's a car that came in near it. It's like it's as bright as like a car light shining into his tent. There's no car there. There's no light there. So he goes back, he starts practicing some more, and the light comes back very bright. He opens up his tent door again. There's nothing there. So, yes, you can. My practice has not developed in that way. Okay. But some people, for some people, it does. There's some people for whom it does. It's what a blessing, yeah. And for those of us who identify with being with just kind of stumbling along or doing okay or struggling with it, I certainly have had years of identifying as somebody who was a struggler in meditation, and I found the arriving sequence to be incredibly beneficial. Just even starting to develop some relationship with that felt sense of ground, or the collectedness of mind and heart. You may already have your own way of starting off meditations for yourself, and if so, deep bows. And if you don't have a way of starting off your meditations, then that's another time when this may be good. Outside of that arriving practice, with that quote from the water polo player, can we continue on with practice just for its own sake? Do we have some kind of demand or insistence about practice, about making progress in some way? How are we measuring progress or results? Great quote from Philip, which I've worked with very quite closely over the last several years. We're practicing practice, we're not practicing results. Or practicing practice. I have used that on whole retreats, long retreats. results come in their own time. It's part of the law of karma that there will be results, right? But they come in their own time and in their own way. Philip talks about the internal committee we have inside, or some people prefer the model of parts, the internal parts. That committee member or those committee members or that part of those parts, they may each individually have a story that they're helping to spread, or that they is the absolute truth to them, or they're keeping that front and center, and they can be very effective at doing that. But even though those stories can feel so powerful and be so dominant in our lives, they're based in the reality of that committee member apart, but they have no inherent truth to them. There is nothing inherently true about them. I hope you've seen this. I hope you've gotten at least small glimpses into this. If you haven't, keep looking, because there are holes to be poked in that. Some story about yourself or some belief about yourself, it can be really useful to start to see through that. That part or that internal committee member, Philip talks about the internal committee, all those voices that we have inside. They're like, we should do this. No, we'll do this. She's always this way, or they're never that, or I never get this, or, whatever it is. That part or that internal committee member is not going to be good. In my experience, those aspects are not good at recognizing the benefit of practice for practice's sake. They just don't see it. They don't, they're on the, they operate on the egoic level, on the level of the ego. We have to have an ego. We have to have a healthy ego. Do not try to get rid of your internal committee members. Do not try to get rid of your parts, anything like that. They're simply, we need them to get by and go about our daily lives and make our way through the world. But they're not going to be good at recognizing insight or noticing some of these subtle things. They do their judging, they're comparing, they're fixing. They have set ideas of how things should look, well, at least for me. And also, at least for me, they don't necessarily have a real willingness to be with experience as it is. So those stories, let them do not need to, they are true to the extent that they exist and they represent what some internal committee member or some part believes, but they don't have inherent truth to them in that. Was listening to Esther Perel's podcast. She is a therapist. She does this, has this podcast, Where Do We Begin? And she often, at least I've essentially almost exclusively heard her working with couples. And really fascinating stuff. But she made a, there was this one episode where I thought she made a significant mistake. There was one partner who was, who had this aspect of himself. He felt like he never got what he deserved. And she asked him if he had a name for that part of himself. And he said, Bitter Boy. And then she kind of starts to mock Bitter Boy a little bit. I'm like, no, love him. Tons of love, so much love. Love up those parts, all of them. They're just doing their thing. They're all arising due to causes and conditions. Okay, back to our 86-year-old water polo player. He said he could do almost anything if he didn't mind not being good at it. What if he had said he could do almost anything if he didn't mind not enjoying it? That would bump it up a level, huh? How much do we make enjoyment a condition for being involved in an activity? I spend a lot of time for myself, a lot of time and energy getting the foods that I like. I buy clothes that I like. I don't buy clothes that I don't like. I like to set the temperature of the shower at the right temperature. I'll season my food to get the taste just right. But I like to get those conditions that make me feel comfortable. But discomfort, whether for you that's a day that's too hot or cold or rainy or a too cool shower or food that's not tasty or unpleasant sounds, I mean, to some extent, that's like an insult to us, right? We haven't been able to get rid of that. What did we, why are we having to deal with this? It's so terrible. Well, I don't think that's the truth. I think we've just become used to getting conditions, right? The physical comfort, the pleasant sounds, the pleasant tastes, smells, thoughts, and emotions, the way we want them. It's nothing more than that. I think doing some of the uncomfortable stuff and actively cultivating being okay with discomfort can be very valuable. Former First Lady Michelle Obama had their daughters do two sports. I think it was sports. It might have been activities in general, but I think it was sports. One was their choice and one was hers. And why did she do that? I want them to understand what it feels like to do something you don't like and to improve. A lot of lessons in that. We're going to have things we dislike in our lives. So in some way, Mrs. Obama was teaching her daughters to practice practice and to not practice results. Philip talks repeatedly about aligning with our values and having that be the barometer, not the outcome. How much were we aligned with our values? And the Buddha talked about results. The results are going to come in their own way. They're part of the law of karma. They come in their own time, their own way. I think I've shared this before. This is Venerable Bodhi's one-sentence summation of the law of karma. I might have the wording exactly right, or it may just be a paraphrasing, but wholesome actions yield favorable results. Unwholesome actions yield unfavorable results. Right? Results are going to come. They can come in this next moment. They could come later in this lifetime. They could come in a future lifetime, at least according to the Buddha. Okay. We humans have mostly tried to keep dukkha at bay. Dukkha is the first noble truth. It's a Pali word most often translated as suffering, but it also it could be translated as unsatisfactoriness, getting what you don't want, not getting what you do want, having to hang out with people who you don't like. All different kinds of definitions, but so mostly we try to keep dukkha at bay by nourishing greed, hatred, and delusion. Could be in minor ways, but the West, the Western world is all about keeping sickness at bay, keeping aging at bay, keeping death at bay, though the aging part has not worked out so well for us as I look around the room here, the virtual room. See how we can do about that in the coming year, huh? As Philip said, we often try to organize our lives around the endless moments of trying to get what we want, or the endless moments of trying to get rid of what we don't want. Sometimes in daily life, it doesn't look that clear. We can't see that clearly, but boy, you do a day-long retreat or a residential retreat or a longer retreat, you start to see that pretty clearly, how much that is moment by moment. Yeah. Before he awakened, the Buddha, his father kept him sheltered from the three heavenly messengers, Well, there were four of them. He kept them sheltered from all four of them. An old person was the first, a sick person was the second, A corpse was the third, and then a renunciant was a fourth. Someone who had gone forth, had left the home life and had shaved their head and gone into the holy life. But he came to see through the efforts to hide them from him, the Buddha did. In many ways, we're just like the Buddha's father, trying to keep all those appearances of dukkha at bay. You know, we try to construct our lives for comfort, having that good food, a nice house, or at least or nice enough, you know, nice clothes, nice health. This is so normal, and there is nothing wrong with it. Okay, let me repeat that. There is nothing wrong with that. It's part of how we're wired as human beings. But dukkha works differently than that. We can't get the conditions just right. And when I say conditions, I mean we can't get the food to taste perfectly and be at that right temperature. We can't change the weather. Sometimes we're going to be warm. Sometimes we're going to be cold. Sometimes we have back pain. Or sometimes there's bigger stuff than that. Catastrophes, accidents, medical issues can take so many shapes. For me, most recently, my wife and I have been going through a very painful experience with some extended family. Nothing health-related, just conflict, pretty much, you know, garden variety conflict that could make for good gossip. For both of us, our sleeping got worse. We both found ourselves at different times rehearsing over and over things to say to this person or ways to get back at them, which fortunately we did not do, right? So let that be a blessing, right? That is dukkha and the cause of dukkha, right? The first noble truth, which is that there is dukkha. There is physical pain. There is emotional pain. We do sometimes have to hang out with people who we don't like and people who do foolish things or harmful things or maybe malicious, right? Or we get a sickness or cancer or something, right? Dukkha, and then the cause of dukkha is our relationship to dukkha. Now, by trying to hold on to the pleasant and or get rid of the unpleasant, we end up that craving there that is the cause of dukkha that helps bring that into our life. And with this situation, I had some amount of working with this as practice and also probably a lot of being caught in it. Then we had a conversation with some friends who are both very active in the Dhamma world, very dedicated practitioners. I've been really admired one of them for their practice for a long time. We were talking with them and the topic of families came up. And as I shared our story and the pain and hurt of it, they shared that they had been through something very similar. Very similar. I mean, this is somebody who is like at a Spirit Rock IMS teacher level, right? He'd been through something very similar. Even a Dhamma teacher was not immune. And so it goes. You know, the Buddha was not immune from that. The Buddha, people called him names all the time. People said very negative things, tried to manipulate what he said and twisted around for their own personal gain. One of his cousins, I think, tried to kill him have him killed. Where is our refuge? It's not in getting conditions right. That is not going to work out. We have our measure of control. Sometimes it seems like it's a lot. Sometimes it seems like it's, you know, really minuscule. We take it where we have it. And to some extent where we have control, or one place where we have control, is around our intention, is how we want to meet this moment through being open to experience as it is. in this family conflict we've been going through, the Dhamma has been extremely helpful. It has helped me to understand there is no freedom. There's no way to get conditions just right. Yeah, and there's no freedom in that. It's helped me to see what is dukkha, the pain of it, what is the cause of it, the thinking, the planning, the perseverating to get conditions just right so it doesn't happen again, so it goes away, so it gets resolved in a pleasing way. Yeah. Anybody here had good luck controlling other people? Just raise your hand if that's true. No, I'm seeing grins, only grins, right? Yeah. So I one kind of point that I want to add here at this point is this. I want to stress that this does not mean that we do not take action to right wrongs, right? If we're in a situation where harm is being caused, we do what we can to stop that, or we make our own decision about that. But it does mean that we might get greater clarity about what's possible in a given situation, and when we can influence that, and when we have to just be with it as it is. Okay. From Venerable Bodhi, from the Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha, translated by Venerable Nyanamoli and Venerable Bodhi. From his introduction to the Middle Length Discourses, I want to read you this paragraph. The Buddha's statement that the five aggregates, these are the five items that make up what we take to be our body and all the kind of mental processes that make up kind of personality and the sense of self and all that kind of thing. So that the five aggregates are dukkha. The Buddha's statement that the five aggregates are dukkha thus reveals that the very thing we identify with and hold to as the basis for happiness, rightly seen, are the basis for the suffering that we dread. Even when we feel ourselves comfortable and secure, the instability of the aggregates, that's a trans, of the five aggregates, is itself a source of oppression and keeps us perpetually exposed to suffering in its more blatant forms. The whole situation becomes multiplied further to dimensions beyond calculation when we take into account the Buddha's disclosure of the fact of rebirth. All beings in whom ignorance and craving remain present wander on in the cycle of repeated existence, samsara, in which each turn brings them the suffering of new birth, aging, illness, and death. All states of existence within samsara, being necessarily transitory and subject to change, are incapable of providing lasting security. Life in any world is unstable. It is swept away. It has no shelter and protector, nothing of its own. Quite powerful there, sums up the Buddha's good synopsis of that. So I want to talk a little bit about, add in a review of the Ratthapala Sutta, Sutta number 82 in the Middle Length Discourses. The Buddha did wander. There were places where he stayed for some longer periods of time, but he also wandered around the countryside and would give his teachings, and he visited this one town. The locals hear he's coming through, they go to see him. The son of one of the wealthiest families attends, and he's immediately drawn to the Buddha's teaching and wants to ordain. So he goes to the Buddha afterward and he says that he wants to ordain, and the Buddha says, "Do you have your parents' permission?" So I'm assuming he was late teens, something like that. And when Ratthapala says no, the Buddha says he has to get that before he can ordain. So he goes and he asks his parents, and his parents say, "You're our only son. You've been raised in comfort, brought up in comfort. You don't know anything about suffering. Even in case of your death, we would lose you unwittingly. How would we give you permission to go forth from the home life into homelessness while you're still living?" Going forth from the home life into homelessness is a kind of stock phrase in the discourses for ordaining, for becoming a monastic. He asks multiple times. They refuse each time. So what does he do? He lays down on the floor and says, "Right here, I shall either die or receive the going forth." So a little got some conviction there. His parents try to talk him out of it. They enlist family. They enlist friends. No luck. Eventually, they acquiesce. It doesn't say how long this goes on, but it does say that after they acquiesced, it says that it took him some time to regain his strength. So he was lying on that floor for a while. So he goes to the Buddha, he ordains, he sets himself to practice. And before long, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Ratapala, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Ratapala became one of the Arahants. It's a pretty stock phrase in the discourses when somebody does attain this awakening there. Okay, so at this point, it says after not long he attained that. In one of the commentaries, they said that it was like so in the discourse it says that he does that, and then he asks the Buddha's permission to travel back home to see his family. And the Buddha grants that. In the commentaries, they say that he'd been practicing for 12 years, which may make sense because when he goes back home, he's not immediately recognized. His father doesn't automatically recognize him. Once they figure out, they invite him offer him the meal the following day. And when he arrives, his father is scheming on ways to get him to leave the holy life. He has all his gold coins and gold bullion laid out in spread out across the whole floor. Apparently he may not have been that young when he left because all of his former wives are there, all made up to the hilt and wearing nice dresses. So doing everything, dad is doing using every trick that he can to try to do this. And Ratapala expresses quite clearly his total lack of interest in the riches or the sex. And he's a bit annoyed. And at one point, after all the show, he turns to his father and he says, "Householder, if there is a meal to be given, then give it. Do not harass us." So after eating, he shares some verses on the futility of sensual lust, returns to the local king's garden where he's been staying. And then the king tries to take a crack at him and says, "Look, people only ordain for four reasons. If they've had some kind of serious loss of some kind, either they got really old or they got really sick or they lost all their money or they lost all their relatives or got banished by their family. But you haven't gone through any of these. Why are you going off to the holy life?" And so Ratapala gives a talk to King Karavya on the four summaries of the Dhamma. Life in any world is unstable. It is swept away towards aging and death. True or false? Well, we certainly can't do now. I can't do what I could do 20 years ago. And some of us, or 30, 40, 50, 70 years ago. Oh. We had more vitality. We could do a lot more back then. It's unstable. It is swept away towards aging and death. Goes in only one direction, right? I mean, yeah. Second summary of the Dhamma: life in any world has no shelter and no protector. Our shelter is unstable. We experience physical pain, emotional pain. We may be able to share some of the emotional pain and have somebody else empathize with us, but they can't actually take it on. if I get a broken bone or some significant injury, or I have some significant chronic condition or something like that, I can't turn to my friends and say, "Oh, share in this discomfort, please." It's not the way it works, right? It's absurd. Our dwelling places, they're unstable. They're subject to fire, to cold, to heat, all this kind of thing. The third summary of the Dhamma: life in any world has nothing of its own. That means one has to leave it all behind and pass it on. King Kauravya was more wealthy than Ratapala's father, but he still couldn't take it with him when he goes. Somebody else is going to inherit that or steal it or whatever. The fourth, life in any world is incomplete, insatiated, the slave of craving. We always want more. So often, so hard to not do that. The endless moments of trying to get what we want, as Philip said. There may not be shelter in the world, but there is shelter from the world. Right? That is what the Buddha offered to all of us. We can use the refuges to provide us that shelter. The refuges of the Buddha, we can look at him and reflect on him as the historical person, or simply as the representative of the possibility of awakening. This is a significant shelter from the storms of this world. We could go to the refuge of the Dhamma, the truth of the way things are, the path of practice that moves us toward that awakening. In whatever measure and at whatever pace, we do not know. It's not up to us to figure out when it's going to happen. But the Dhamma is certainly a shelter from the storm. And the third refuge, the Sangha, the inspiration and the support of like-minded practitioners. This is definitely also a shelter from the storm. So I hope that my wish for each of us, for myself and for all of you, is that may we all learn to go to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha for refuge more fully and more regularly. In minor ways, we recite these chants of the three refuges. Maybe it's that you do that, start doing that in your own practice every morning. Or maybe that's that, when you head out the door, you just, on a heart level, you connect with the refuge of going to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha as refuge, or just one of the three. So that we can see more clearly when we're trying to get things just right and can come back to the Dhamma, to the true refuge there. Thank you for your attention, for your kind attention. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, Mary.
So, thank you very much. So, I wanted to say that I use the arriving sequence for my meditation. I do start with it, but I also use it during the course of the day. So I have things on my watch, my phone, that tell me to breathe and tell me to whatever. And one of the things I can use is I will use that, and I it's like Philip used to say. Just sometimes he would just say, "Are you available?" But I would kind of like, "Am I here? Have I arrived?" And then I and okay, "Am I available?" And for me, being available is almost like, is my heart space open, or am I contracted? And I can, and that's, and for me, it's like if I drop into my body, then I know. It's, I can feel it. And then it's like, if what we do is not going to be about results, then it really needs to be about something. And usually for me, it's what I'm, for me, it's right view and wholesome intentions. And this is like such an ongoing process, probably till like my deathbed, I'll be like, there as well. But it makes it easier. It makes it easier for me to be with things that I don't like. You know, it really does. And it is for me, just even that sequence is in itself a refuge, because the present moment itself sometimes can be a refuge, no matter what the circumstances are. If I can just be there, then it is. So thank you very much for like really very practical look at the Dhamma and the Four Noble Truths. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Yeah. Yeah, I think that in the present moment, there can be, if there's dukkha, we can know it. And if there's the cause of dukkha there, if we are caught in craving, that certainly happens to me plenty. If we're caught in craving, we can know that more fully and see that. And then we can get to the third noble truth, the letting go of that craving. So, yes, Bill.
Yeah, I just enjoyed the story about the water polo player. It reminded me of a saying that if you want to become a good guitar player, you have to be willing to spend a lot of time being a bad guitar player.
So true. So true. Yeah.